It's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Andrew Knowlton and I sit down with Georgia's own Hugh Atchison. Actually, he's not even from Georgia. He's Canadian. But been in Georgia a long time, a fierce advocate of Southern cooking. He's the owner of 5 and 10 and the National in Athens, Georgia, the Florence in Savannah, and Empire State South in Atlanta. Written a bunch of books. You've seen him on Top Chef. So Andrew Knowlton and I talked to Hugh about the state of modern Southern cuisine, what to order at the Waffle House, and how Hugh might even be a better artist than he is a chef. All right, let's do this. Hugh Atchison, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to New York. We were supposed to hook up with you in Portland last month, but your flight got delayed.
What happened? Flight got delayed massively on the way out there.
Well, Knowlton and I were observing, if you follow you on Instagram or Twitter, you fly a lot.
I do fly a lot. I've been doing just a lot of stuff.
And I think we were wondering why.
Consulting and just different guest chef gigs, a lot of during the summer. I mean, festival season and stuff like that. But I don't do that many festivals anymore. So 3 or 4 or 5, maybe a year.
Are you a travel junkie though? Do you feel like if you're at home for more than 2 months that you get that jonesing to hit the road?
2 months, one two, or
two
weeks,
months, 2 days.
2 days.
Yeah, I mean, I like traveling.
You know, your wife might hear this.
Yeah,
podcast.
I know she'll hear it. That's okay. I've heard it from her. So no, I mean, I think the life of chefdom these days when you have a number of restaurants and you're just. You're offered a lot of other things to do and consult and help other brands out and things like that.
Well, because it's interesting because being a chef these days, you're more than a chef. You're a business person. You're an entrepreneur, and you have to sort of. It seems you have to maintain a momentum of constantly or at a steady flow of doing new things, new projects. How do you decide what to do, what not to do? How do you maintain that balance?
Balance is probably the most difficult thing. I think you just have to analyze every project like it's 100% your own, whether it's just a consulting thing or not. And you have to be behind it and you have to believe in the project. But we all have to pay the bills too. Yeah. So, you know, in a low margin business, this buffers it by a lot by doing some other things.
The low margin business being running a restaurant.
Being running four restaurants, yeah.
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 You're trying to make up for all your poor decisions.
Yes. Over the many, many years I've been doing this. So.
But I imagine sometimes it's like, you know, it's like being an actor. You need to take that blockbuster movie because you need a paycheck. And there's certain jobs you must do because, like, hey, that's going to pay well and that'll allow me to do these other things that are more interesting or for a
yeah,
good cause.
But we're under a radar and there's transparency in the world. So, you know, we have to be careful about brands we represent and what we do and how we do it. You know, if a major chicken plant place, you know, wants me to pimp their stuff, I'm probably going to say no. You know, it's just not because it just doesn't align with my food policy stuff that I do and that I don't get paid for and I'm very active in. And I've got a mandate to get across what I feel about food and it's important. So you have to be, you don't want to be contradictory.
What's the last like consulting gig you've been doing that you've been proud of and that you're psyched about?
We did some work with a Denver-based group called Punch Bowl Social that's expanding greatly. They're at 7 units now across this. And it's kind of like Brooklyn Bowl. I mean, they're beautiful, sort of millennial-focused bowling alleys and karaoke rooms and stuff like that.
Do you know this joint, Knowlton?
I do not. Wow.
And there's one in Austin and Portland and Denver.
So is it a little bit like Alamo Draft House in Austin? And there's one in Williamsburg now in Alamo Draft House.
No, it's not movies. It's more gaming.
Okay. But now decent food.
We revamped their food program and got stuff that we think is really doable for their crews in there and really took a different focus on their food.
So with a gig like that, because you always hear about chefs being brought on as consultants, how does that work? Do you go in for a couple of days, talk to them? Do you actually develop dishes with them in their kitchens? Like, who's doing what?
Yeah, I mean, they have a full set of amazing chefs. So I can go and give them a new sort of menu and test out recipes and down to the gram and everything and figure it out already for them and just sort of plot their direction a little bit and just give them a, what I'm trying to do is take nuance that we find in independent fine dining and bring it to a larger scale, mm-hmm. which is, to me, it's fun because it's challenging. Yeah. How do you do that? Yeah. And how do you preach sustainability and beliefs in from scratch cooking in, you know, businesses that really are profitable because they cut corners. So we're trying to make them not cut corners at all and really do great food.
But you also must have to, this being a consulting gig, you must have to be very mindful of the margins and food costs and all that sort of stuff. Yes? No? Maybe?
I mean, yes and no, but they're setting all that stuff on their own.
Let them worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, not let them worry about it. We want to be smart with them, but that's not my primary concern.
Did you have to go do research trips to Dave and Buster's just to see what the thing was?
Yeah. I mean, no.
Have you been to a Dave and Buster's before?
I never have.
Oh, no.
I have not either.
I've been to Chuck E. Cheese.
You never took your daughters to Dave and Buster's?
No.
That's an adult arcade.
Is it? There's one in Times Square now, and my son, I've had to take him there a few times, and it's like an assault on your sensory system. Just like, because the
How
games
old is
now,
your son?
He's nine now, or almost
nine.
And you
take him to the adult arcades?
It's not an adult arcade. It's got video games. Yes, there's a bar area, but it's like...
Does Chuck E. Cheese serve beer?
I don't know.
I have a question, Hugh. You're very active on Instagram and Twitter, and mm-hmm. I follow you on both. What's your handle, Hugh Atchison?
Atchison?
Yep.
At Hugh Atchison on both.
I have two questions. One is, when you respond to Delta about your bad trips that you have, do they respond to you and give you stuff for free? Does that work?
Well,
you're always like at Delta, like, thanks a lot, Delta, for the delay.
I'm not mean about it. I want to be funny with them because I see how many people. It used to be at Delta Assist, but they actually got rid of it. Now you have to go to at Delta for everything.
Okay.
But Delta, I fly a lot. And actually, Delta, I love you. Sometimes it's really positive. Sometimes it's negative. I'm not griping like to no one. I'm just griping to the whole organization. Yeah. But you know what? Oddly enough, they respond.
Do they
respond really promptly, and it's hilarious. And we have this great repartee between me and some Delta people. So,
so my next question is, how much is social media must a chef in 2016 engage in that? You enjoy it, I think.
Yeah.
It comes across.
It's me. It's sincere.
It's sincere. But how much, you have to have a presence on social media if you're a chef.
Do you?
I think you do.
I mean, I think you do and you don't. I mean, I think the concept of being a chef these days is people want to understand you and they want to understand your life. And I think they want to understand it more than food. I think that... it's, you know, if I ran my own personal account as a chef of just pictures of the food I did, I would expect that unless that food was stunningly beautiful to look at, that you would get extraordinarily bored.
Right.
But pictures of my shoes and airport carpets to me are interesting.
And it sort of
document where you are in life and what you're doing and what you're going through.
But you also share your personal life, which I'm always kind of torn about on my Instagram feed. Like, you share pictures of your daughters and stuff, and I don't know. I'm always like, wait, do people want to see that? Or is that sort of like, you know, how do you sort of decide what to share personally?
I ask them.
So your daughters have a say in the matter?
Yeah.
Do you really ask them?
Yeah, I usually
after
do.
The fact
Unless
or before?
Unless it's thoroughly embarrassing, then I'll just go ahead and post it. But, you know, I don't know. It's like in this world where there's so much information out there already, it doesn't really matter. You want to Google pictures of my kids?
Yeah.
Don't be creepy about it, but they're out there. It's like, whatever.
Yeah, it comes and goes pretty quickly these days. You also have on your, I feel like I do know you, but I feel like I really know you just because I follow you on Twitter and Instagram. And people, like, that's the crazy thing about Instagram and stuff. Like, people you haven't seen in a year, like, oh my God, your vacation looks so amazing. How was it? How was Sicily? And you're like, wow, I have not even talked to you since 1990, but they know exactly where you went.
No, no, usually it's like, I have never met you, but. Yeah.
But it's like, we share it. It's like, you have no one to blame.
I mean,
you put it out there.
Hey, yeah, we put it out there. It's like, it doesn't matter.
Let's talk about one thing you do on your Instagram. You carry around these little booklets of graph paper, like you're a dungeon master in D&D and you're drawing up little sketches. What, you sketch a lot, or like, what's your whole booklet
I sketch a lot.
Deal?
I mean, it's just to document stuff.
Ooh, wow, you just open it up in color. Look at that. I've never the color.
I travel with watercolors. It's
no,
just
real, that's
stuff.
Not water. That's magic marker,
no,
right?
Wait, was watercolors. That a Bon Appetit picture in that? Wait, go back one more. Is that a BA
that
picture?
Is. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wait, so what? So you're explain. So you're flipping through. You've got these beautiful little sketches in
it's
color.
It's maps. Like, this is Portland. So that's the basic whatever. And this is all the places that I ate and hung out at. And
here's Shoreshoes.
Just whatever.
So you're, whatever. Like, you're sitting at a bar by yourself doing this, waiting
usually
for a plane?
Usually it's me sitting
what?
On the plane doing this because I know I have real work to do. So
ooh, look at this radish. You have nice, beautiful radishes. Is there a work purpose to this? Like, oh, I want to take notes. I want to get
often
back to
documenting dishes that we're coming up with, but or it's like trips. Like, this is a trip coming up to Reykjavik.
And you have beautiful little photos from magazine cut and pasted in there.
Yeah,
cut
it's
out
just
and pasted.
Doodles and stuff, you know? It's like, whatever.
So have you incorporated... Your books haven't had any of these pretty cool drawings that you're showing, have they?
Wait, that is literally watercolor.
The first book did.
The first one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like really do. I'm not lying.
You travel with watercolors.
Yeah, they're in my bag.
Wow.
It's just a little watercolor kit.
That is impressive. I feel like such a...
He's a Renaissance man, this guy. Don't forget, he's not American. He's Canadian.
Well, I noticed
that.
A moment ago you said, oot. I went out.
Yeah.
You're not from around these parts.
You get a house and about.
Yeah.
About.
Are the tells of the Canadian. Yeah. But I'm actually dual now, which is great.
Does it come out more when you've had a few, like, Molsons?
Yes,
From Ottawa.
I'm from Ottawa.
Ottawa.
Lived in Montreal for a long time.
Okay.
So
how long did it, you know, you, I feel like you were a big part of the Southern Renaissance in food.
Explain the Southern Renaissance.
Well, I think there was a...
I don't know what he's talking about, so that's good.
I think, well, I can only speak for me personally. There, having grown up in Atlanta, Georgia, there was a kind of a renewed appreciation for a lot of the foods that some of us grew up with that weren't thought of as being kind of high-end dining to some extent, that there was this whole canon to explore and to rediscover a lot of the ingredients that had been lost. And I feel like you and some other Atlanta chefs and some, you know, people from Charleston were kind of, I don't know. I mean, I became a proud Southerner when you guys were doing that food, and it made me appreciate, having been away, appreciate what I grew up with.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was interesting because I am Canadian.
Yeah.
And so I have this very objective look at Southern food that a lot of Southerners don't get the benefit of.
Absolutely.
Because Southerners have this penchant for doing things like, well, my grandmother makes the best biscuits.
Right.
And even if they're not the best biscuits,
they're still
they have to say
And you can't
that.
Argue with that.
No, you can't argue with that. But one thing I did quickly understand when I was down there and living down there, and I mean, I've been down there on and off for 25 years, is that it's the culinary hardwood of the entire North America. I mean, it's got more to it and more nuance and interesting and stories.
Did you trademark that line?
No.
The culinary hardwood.
Well, versus everywhere else
I
is
like
veneer.
Have you used that before?
That,
the veneer.
The veneer. Everything else is...
Well, which is not a bad thing. Veneer can be beautiful, but
goddamn,
it's just... It doesn't
goddamn
have
Renaissance man over here. you watercolor, you're a wordsmith, you cook. Jesus.
I spoken word poetry, my walks on the beach, I made my own canoe.
Wait, literally?
No. So, you know, California cuisine is definitely an important part of the American landscape now as we know it. But California cuisine was developed 30 years ago, 35 years ago, by people like Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters.
And right. He's not even from California.
And other cultures have a good amount of food history to them. But nothing is as storied and interesting and documented as Southern food. Now, Southern food needs to be very clearly defined as it isn't done being defined. It's not a particular point in time.
Right.
But it does have a huge legacy of history to it. A lot of that is born out of slavery and a lot of very painful things in the past. So it's coming to terms with things that I think are finally starting to happen. But the fine dining aspect of turning regular a food that was meant for everyone into fine dining fare is a really dangerous slippery slope. And we've been careful to walk it in the right way, I think, with the food we're trying to serve at the restaurants every day if they have a Southern bent to it. But you can gussy up a thing of chicken and dumplings. That's fine. But, you know, the age of selling grits for $8 is like, I don't know. But there are aspects to that stuff that I like. There are aspects that I don't like.
Playing the devil's advocate, if I were from...
Really?
Yeah,
you?
I know.
Didn't see this coming.
Kel surprise. Let's say if I were from Georgia, I'm like, wait a minute. I don't want this dude from Ottawa telling me how to make Southern food. He's not even from like Toronto or a real city. It's like, really? He's coming down here to tell me how to make Southern food?
Dude, you can punch him if you want.
I mean, not literally. I'm going to punch him in a figurative way. I would look you straight in the head and say, if that's the Southern food you believe in, you have no idea where it came from. And the fact that it wasn't brought here by people who were from here. It was brought on in the bottom of boats.
I imagine when you first started out, did you get that? And was that something you had to respond to?
I got that most famously in a big CNN piece I wrote about Southern food and calling it an episode in which Paula Deen and I went back and forth on stage one time in a friendly, banterish manner about what is Southern food. And there were a lot of responses in it got like 800 responses. And it was, some of them were really crass. What do you know? You're not from around here. Mm-hmm. Which is the stupid equivalent of saying doesn't mean anything. I know more about Southern food than the person who wrote that. Yeah. But I'm still learning. I'm learning everything about it every day, and I enjoy doing that. But it is a complex thing. But it just because there's somewhere, I think that Andy Ricker proves that just because you're not from Thailand doesn't mean you can't cook excellent Thai food.
You can still have a passion for something more than somebody who's from that part.
Yeah.
But do you find pleasure or does it bother you at all that, if you go to LA or you go to Portland or you go to Boston that you can get pimento cheese sandwiches and shrimp and grits? Do you find somehow there's a exploitation of the South going on in terms of the ingredients and bastardizing it?
Yeah, I mean, the export out of the South of some things like that has been very selective and very odd. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the collection of what they think, ooh, Southern-y, is. So, at some point in time, I'm susceptible to the same thing, which is you don't really understand the South in your sort of Jim Crow era strange restaurant that you've created here serving shrimp and grits in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And it just doesn't really make sense. But I think that Southern food is so deep that those people can take those things and make them. I just don't want to see them gussy it up as being too Southern. To me, I just want it to be good food. Right. And good food can be a bowl of grits in New York, and that's fine.
But let's say if you were to open a restaurant in New York or maybe up in Montreal or Toronto or something, would you open a Southern restaurant or do you think you would make it more just sort of modern American-ish, whatever kind of food is prevalent these days?
Yeah, I think I cook less and less firmly in a Southern vernacular anyhow. So I think it'd just be the food that I do. And, that's relatively, taking a lot of different aspects of the world. But, I'm most interested in food that's just really pure, always has a sense of history, and I'm probably most interested in combining the ideas of French food with Southern food.
But
in all of ways.
But all right, so you're working on another cookbook, and you've got cookbooks out. Do you feel though that like publishers and whatnot, they want to sort of peg you as Southern food authority, Hugh Atchison? And do you feel like you need to play to that sometimes to promote further your brand, as they say?
No, I think the typecasting has kind of gone away. It's definitely I'm still labeled as a Southern chef.
Yeah.
And
helps sometimes.
It helps sometimes. I mean, Southern food is still in its good days of getting coverage and being of interest to people. Mm-hmm. I don't think any chef gets called a Northern chef.
No, they don't. Are you, Nolton said you got a new cookbook in the works?
I have a book on using a slow cooker in a very contemporary way.
That's interesting to me because that is something that people don't think of as a chef's tool that they would use in the kitchen. What's
the
deal?
All my books are not meant to be restaurant cookbooks.
No?
They're just not. I mean, they're meant to be cookbooks that you actually use at home.
So why do you love a slow cooker? I mean, what is it about a slow cooker that you wanted to do a whole cookbook about it?
Because the publisher asked me to.
Oh, this
is how we do business. Come on. I think I was born yesterday. Come on, son. It's applicable and it's interesting. I think it's coming back into something. People want to get back in the kitchen, but they're terrified of getting back in the kitchen. They're terrified of cooking from scratch. So we needed them to find the tools that make that easier for them. And it's kind of a segue. It's getting them back in there slowly but surely.
I have a question about the slow cooker, of which my in-laws are fans. Is it not any different than what's it? Is it just a why can't I just put a Le Creuset in the oven for 3 hours? You're looking like I'm crazy.
Because you live in New York, nobody uses their oven, their clothes in there.
But what is the upside of a slow cooker exactly?
It's just relatively, you could mimic the same thing.
Yeah, but you can just do this on your countertop.
But a slow cooker costs like $75. Your oven and your Le Creuset pot, I'm just tabbling it up as $4,800.
My mom used to cook, and she still does, but it was more of a I don't know if people should do this, but would set it in the morning and then come home after teaching school and it would be done.
Yeah.
And ready to
serve. And that's really the point of them and why they're there. But I mean, I don't know if I'd want to walk away from a downtown New York apartment with the oven on, even just at $275. But a slow cooker is just,
I mean, listen, you can go to the bar and have a drink or two and come back.
I mean, you leave your kids in the house, go have to the bar, have a drink or two. It's just like a slow cooker, an oven on. It's no big deal.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
I actually had this discussion with my mom, who grew up in Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and like she would say that would have her relatives all the time. Where they would leave the kids in the crib and they would just go down to the corner tavern, like, you know, like in Green Bay and stuff. Every corner has a little tavern that's part of the people who live there. And like, yeah, that's just kind of what you did.
We rolled around the backseat, not no seatbelts,
not whatever. Not that we're advocating this. No. I'm just saying it happened. You know, we also want to talk about Ryan Smith, the chef at
Staple House,
which Andrew Knowlton just named the best new restaurant in America. And apparently he used to work for you for a number of years.
You know, Ryan's actually a partner at Empire State's House.
Too. Still?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he bought it after. He came in as a partner after he left. Ryan came on board as the chef of Empire State South and worked there for almost 3 years as the executive chef. We're very, very close friends. Ryan is a brilliant, brilliant human and a brilliant chef. And that restaurant is just such a beautiful story that you guys told very, very well. But that whole saga of what they've done there and how hard they've worked and the legacy behind it and the Giving Kitchen and all that is just, it's heartfelt, it's beautiful, and it's the most authentic restaurant that anybody's done in years.
It was interesting to me, having eaten at Empire State South a few times and then to go to Staple House, is the food that he was doing at Empire State South was, you know, that was a combination, I'm sure, of your food and what he wanted to do. But then when he opened Staple House was much more, you know, not complex, but the techniques involved seem to be a lot more intricate. And, and there's a lot of fermentation and crazy stuff
there
going on.
There was a lot of that going on at Empire, too. I think he just pushed it to the next level and when he went to the Staple House.
So what do you think he took from you and cooking at Empire State South for 3 years?
I think that Ryan learned a lot about leadership at Empire. I think he learned a lot about how to be a chef that's not only looking at the four walls of a kitchen, but realizing the entirety of a space and what it means to oversee everything in a restaurant. That's so important to be a good chef nowadays. Mm. I think if you just look at the four walls of your kitchen and never understand the experience the guests are having out there or how it's so intertwined to the waiter's approach to the table, to how the host is and to the beverages and everything. He learned a lot of that there and he learned to be a great leader, and I trusted him and gave him a lot of leeway to do that. But, Ryan and I work really well together as chefs together. So it's been a very easy friendship, but a very great business relationship over the years too. Mm-hmm. So
do you know when you have someone like that, and you're seeing them grow the way they've grown, do you know that I'm going to lose this guy at some point because he or she is that talented and has that potential?
Yes and no. I mean, we see it. I don't think Ryan would have left under any other circumstances but to just open Staple House. Yeah, he had a good job and was getting well rewarded for it financially. And I think that it was just a confluence of things that had to happen to take the legacy of other Ryan, who passed away, and really make it something. This was something they had planned together, and he needed to do it. And so I understood that. But to really answer your question, I'm hell-bent on hiring people who are better and smarter and more talented than I am.
That's hard to do.
Well,
you're Hugh Atchison.
It's actually easy to do.
Can they do watercolors?
They cannot, but they are going to be great in different ways and leaders in different ways and have skill sets that are very different from mine. And my job is to, I'm the baseball manager now.
Yeah.
I put the team on the field and I figure out the best people to play those positions. When I find somebody who's an all-star and who's going to be amazing, what we try and do first is really invest in them and give them a partnership in the build in a new project that we're working on that's really up their alley that I think is good. And we've done that with Kyle Giacovino at the Florence and Savannah. We've done it with Dale Donche, who is Spiller Park in Ponce Market in Atlanta, mm-hmm. which is our coffee shop. We did it with Peter Dale at the National in Athens. So all these things are really meant to be me identifying people who I don't want to lose, not because they're so talented and I don't want them to compete with me. Mm-hmm. It's more so that I just want to be surrounded by these people. Yeah. And I want to work with them, and they're talented. Mm-hmm. It's great to find them.
Before we get to our lightning round, I just want to say for you listeners, if you want to learn more about Staple House and what we've been talking about, you can go to bonappetit.com or just search on Google, probably easier. Bon Appetit and Staple House. Andrew wrote a beautiful story about Ryan Smith and the legacy of Ryan Heidegger, the original chef there. And also there's a beautiful video, like a 9-minute documentary we shot. Check that out. But now, Hugh, we're doing lightning round. Nolan, you want to go first?
I'll go first. So lightning round, just quick answers. Got to choose one.
Okay.
I'm going to go with okra or collards?
Okra.
Okra. Fried?
No.
Stewed?
Grilled.
Grilled.
Grilled, ooh.
Touché, my friend.
Wow. I'm just going straight to this one. Chick-fil-A or Waffle House?
Two very different beasts. I'm going to go for Waffle House.
What's your order?
BLT sandwich.
Nice.
And
on the Texas toast bread or the regular toast?
Scattered and peppered hash brown. On the Texas toast bread.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Not an egg guy.
Let's go with Senators or Braves.
Senators.
Ottawa Senators, the hockey team from where you're from.
One. Yeah, no.
I was thinking like Washington Senators.
Or
like,
Braves. Yeah. I'm going to go Montreal Canadiens.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Montreal Canadiens. Fair enough.
Yeah. Canadiens.
No, yep. Senators from Ottawa? That's where you're from.
I know, but when I grew up watching hockey, the Senators, who were original six team, they were not in existence then. They came back in like 1989 or something.
Nor were they good. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Senators. But
and the Habs. They're the Habs. Yeah.
They're the Habs.
Okay, how about, I like this one. Triscuits or Ritz crackers?
Triscuits.
With the pimento cheese?
Yeah. That's a good match.
Yeah.
Let's go sweet tea or Coca-Cola?
Neither.
Wow.
Ooh.
I don't like sweet beverages.
You're not Southern.
I'll take a half and half tea.
Okay. Half lemonade, half iced tea. Which would also be a...
Arnold Palmer. Or I'll do half unsweet and half sweet.
Yeah. I'm with you on that.
I don't know what this has to do with the South or with Canada, but gnocchi or nudie?
Gnocchi.
How do you like your gnocchi? Do you make gnocchi?
I make gnocchi.
Good gnocchi?
Good gnocchi. Yeah.
Basic tomato sauce? What do you like?
Yeah, or like a lamb, braised lamb.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah. Lots of fresh mint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so.
You know what you can cook that lamb in? A slow cooker.
You can.
Time you get home from work, it's like 6:45, it's falling apart tender.
Or you can get a Le Creuset and put it in your oven at 275 while you're getting drunk downstairs and the kids are bopping down upstairs, whatever.
All right. Hopefully you know what I'm talking about here. Beaver tails or Krispy Kreme?
Beaver tails.
Tell us what beaver tails are.
Because I don't know.
Beaver tails are like, it looks like a pita bread, but it's a slightly sweet dough that's a fried dough. And then once it comes out and it's looks like the shape of a beaver's tail, it is done with brown sugar or granulated white sugar and then usually lemon juice and cinnamon.
Oh, interesting.
It's great.
Where do I get a beaver tail?
You get them in Ottawa at the Byward Market in little stands.
Ooh, They smell really good.
I've had one beaver tail, and that was in the market in Toronto. There was a special Ottawa thing, and they were doing beaver tails. And when you hear the name beaver tail, you want to try it.
You do.
On a similar note, poutine or nachos?
Poutine.
I'm over the whole poutine thing. It's just like gloppy stuff on top of my french fries.
You know
like,
what?
It's too much stuff. Like the fries get soggy.
The fries are supposed to get
soggy. No, they're not. Fries are supposed to be crispy. Put the stuff on the side and then you can dip it in there. You know what's better than cheese fries?
You're telling french the Canadian? Fries. I am going to regionalize this. You don't know what you're talking about. Okay. Look, there are certain regional foods in this world that should not be made anywhere else, and poutine is one of them. Poutine should stay in Quebec and maybe in Ottawa.
I agree
and,
with that.
You know, if I go to a poutine bar in Portland, Oregon, you know, it's like what the fuck? Come
after
on, guys.
After I go to Wanda's in Montreal, I want to go to have poutine.
Yeah,
if you know what I'm talking about. Creature Comforts or Budweiser?
Creature Comforts.
Tell us what Creature Comforts is.
Creature Comforts is a wonderful small brewery in Athens, Georgia that is just making some amazing, amazing beers. And they're different beers. They're really light and beautiful and citrusy almost and really refreshing. They're great Southern beers. There is nothing wrong with a cold Budweiser like I'm drinking now.
Right.
It is the king of beers.
Says so in the can.
It says so. That's what I'm
It would be
reading.
False advertising if it weren't.
That's right. So, but Creature Comforts is great and it's a beautiful venue and I've got an amazing tasting program during the day and they've just been inordinately successful and they've just got some really amazing people behind them.
All right. Last question because we got to go. Olive oil or butter?
Butter.
Right. Hugh Atchison, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.